The summer had been generous to Ellingham Court. Too generous, perhaps. The kind of afternoon that flatters everything it touches and makes cruelty look like carelessness. The lawn was full of the county's best faces, parasols tilted against the sun, the low murmur of conversation rising and falling like water over stone. Miss Esther Wren sat at the edge of the family circle, where she had sat for 6 years, near enough to be useful, far enough to pretend she did not notice the distinction. She was 39 years old, the daughter of a country clergyman who had left her nothing but a good education and a clear eye, and she had spent the last 6 years being indispensable to a household that did not quite consider her part of it. She held her teacup with both hands. She watched Flora, the Duke's 8-year-old daughter, chase a garden hat across the grass, and she smiled at the sight without thinking, the kind of smile that appears before you can stop it, because it belongs to something you love. It was that smile, perhaps, that gave her away. Or perhaps it was simply the Dowager Duchess Augusta's gift for finding the softest place in a room and pressing on it, hard, in front of everyone. "There she is," Augusta said, not troubling to lower her voice. Her words carried cleanly across 20 feet of manicured grass, arriving at every ear simultaneously. The Duke's little mistake. Every head turned. Esther felt the turn before she saw it. A shift in the air, a collective intake. The particular silence that follows a weapon being drawn in public. She looked at Nathaniel. Nathaniel Devereux, Duke of Ellingham, stood 6 feet away with a glass of something cold in his hand. He was 42, dark-haired, with the kind of face that had been called handsome so often it had stopped meaning anything. And he was looking at his mother with an expression that passed through three things very quickly. Recognition, calculation, and something that might have been panic, before it settled into the thing it always settled into. He laughed. It was his famous laugh. Easy, light, the sound of a man who found the world perpetually amusing, and himself most amusing of all. The county relaxed. A few people chuckled uncertainly. Augusta's mouth curved with satisfaction. Someone near the rose arbor resumed their conversation, and the moment passed. For everyone on the lawn, except the woman holding the teacup. Esther set the cup down on the small wrought iron table beside her chair. One precise sound, like a period at the end of a sentence. She did not run. She did not flush or tremble or look away. She stood, smoothed the front of her gray dress with one hand, and walked back toward the house at the pace of someone who has decided where she's going and sees no reason to hurry. The laughter was still in the air behind her. She walked through it as through a door, and then she was inside, in the cool stone hall, and the door swung shut at her back. She did not stop walking until she reached the narrow staircase that led to the upper rooms where the servants and the governess slept, and then she stopped and stood very still for a moment with her hand on the banister, and the only sound was her own breathing. She packed methodically. The trunk was not large, she had never accumulated much, and she worked in the order that made sense. Heaviest at the bottom, the things she would need first laid on top. The sounds of the garden party continued below and then shifted, after an hour, into the sounds of a dinner she was not attending. She listened to the clink and murmur as she folded her second best dress and placed it beside her father's Bible, which was the only thing she owned that she would not have left under any circumstances. She was not crying. She had expected, in some part of herself, that she had never looked at directly, that a day like this would come, and she had always imagined she would cry. She did not. What she felt instead was something colder and more precise. The sensation of a door she had been leaning against for 6 years, finally swinging open, so that she stumbled forward into space. And the only thing she knew for certain was that the room behind her had never been hers. the Duke's little mistake. She had told herself. Since the moment she first understood what she felt for Nathaniel Devereaux, that she was not a fool. She had told herself she had no expectations. She had told herself that a clergyman's daughter with empty pockets, however well-educated, however genuinely loved by the child in her care, was not the kind of woman who ended up belonging to a house like this. She had told herself all of it, carefully, for years. And she had believed it, mostly. And she had stayed anyway. Because Flora needed her. Because the work was real. Because she had made something of herself in those six rooms and that garden. And because she was not, despite everything, entirely free of hope. The laugh had settled the question. She went to Flora's nursery at 9:30. The child was in bed, her dark hair loose on the pillow, a book she had been pretending to read face down on the coverlet. Flora looked up when Esther came in, and her face arranged itself into the particular expression she wore when she knew something was wrong and was deciding whether to ask. "Miss Wren," she said. "Good night, sweetheart," Esther said. She sat on the edge of the bed and smoothed the hair back from Flora's forehead, a gesture she had performed 1,000 times. So familiar, it had become a kind of language between them. "You're saying good night differently," Flora said. She was 8 and very sharp, and she had never been easy to manage, which was one of the things Esther loved most about her. "I'm saying it the usual way." "You're not." Flora reached up and took hold of Esther's wrist with both small hands, the way she did when she was trying to prevent something she couldn't name. "Will you be here in the morning?" Esther looked at the child's face for a long moment. She had rehearsed something, a gentle deflection, a promise to explain later. Some version of the truth that would not break what needed to stay whole until she was safely away. None of it came out. "I love you very much," she said instead. "That is always true, whatever happens." Flora held on tighter. Esther let her hold on for a count of 20, which was longer than she had intended. And then she carefully unwound the small fingers and tucked them back under the coverlet and stood. "Sleep," she said, in the voice that meant she was not going to be argued with. She was gone before the house was fully dark. Meryton was 12 miles east of Ellingham, a market town built around a modest church and a river that flooded every other spring. Esther's father had held a curacy here for 3 years before she was born. She had heard him describe it often enough that she felt she knew the shape of its streets before she arrived. The widow above the apothecary, a small woman named Mrs. Price, who smelled permanently of lavender and had no patience for sentiment, rented 2 upstairs rooms for a sum that took the last of Esther's quarterly wages and left her with enough for perhaps 3 weeks of plain meals. She spent a portion of that remainder on slates, a second-hand primer with a cracked spine, and a card for the church notice board, which she lettered herself in her best hand. "Reading and letters for girls. No fee for the first month. Inquire above the apothecary." 6 children appeared on the first morning. They ranged from 5 to 11, and they were variously shy, bold, suspicious, and entirely uninterested in sitting still. And by the end of the first hour, Esther's back ached, and her voice had gone rough from projecting across a room that was not quite large enough and not quite warm enough. And she was more fully occupied than she had been in years. By the 3rd week, there were 14. The vicar, Mr. Alderton, a mild, nearsighted man who had known her father slightly, offered the use of the vestry on mornings when the room above the apothecary grew too crowded. One of the local farmers sent his daughter, and then, a week later, sent a side of bacon as what he called a contribution to the educational enterprise, which made Mrs. Price laugh for the first time since Esther had known her. A woman named Mrs. Farrow, whose husband kept the mill, began appearing at the end of each morning session to collect her twin daughters and staying, increasingly, to ask questions about the letters they had been learning. And Esther, without quite planning it, found herself teaching two generations at once. She was no longer anyone's governess. She was no longer anyone's anything. She had a handwritten card on a church notice board and 14 girls who needed to learn to read, and the work was entirely her own. And she discovered, with a feeling she had no name for, something between vertigo and relief, that the ground beneath her was solid in a way she had never felt when it belonged to someone else. He came in October, 6 weeks after the garden party, on a Tuesday when the morning session had just ended and the last of the girls were still collecting their slates. Esther heard the step on the stair, heavier than Mrs. Price's, unfamiliar, and turned to find Nathaniel Devereaux standing in the doorway of her schoolroom in a coat that cost more than she earned in a year, looking at the chalk-dusted walls and the rows of small benches as though he had arrived somewhere he had not expected. He waited until the last child had gone. Then he came in and he took off his hat and he said her name. Not Miss Wren, just Esther, which he had never done before. And she understood from that alone that he had rehearsed this and was trying to be honest. "I owe you an apology," he said. "I know that. I've known it since the moment I heard my own voice." He was not using his social manner. It was the first time she had seen him without it, and it made him look older and more real. I laughed. I should not have laughed. Whatever I thought it would accomplish, I should not have done it. And I am sorry. Esther looked at him for a long moment. The afternoon light came through the small window at a low angle and caught the chalk dust still hanging in the air between them. "I heard you," she said. "I want to ask you something, and I want you to answer it plainly, without the charm. Can you do that?" He answered quietly. "Yes." "When your mother said what she said, what did you feel?" He was quiet for a moment. There was not a hesitation, but a reckoning. "Rage," he said. "And fear." "Fear of what?" "Of what she would do next, if she saw that it mattered." Esther nodded slowly. "And so you laughed," she said. "And I stood in front of the entire county and heard the man I..." She stopped. She began again, more carefully. "I stood in front of every family in this county and heard a sound that told me I was nothing. Your private feeling, whatever it was, did not show up in that moment. It stayed inside you where it was safe, and I was left standing in the open. That is what happened." She kept her voice level. Not because she was not angry, but because the anger had already done its work. It had carried her 12 miles and built a school, and she did not need it to carry her any further. "A feeling that costs you nothing in public is worth nothing to me. That is not cruelty. That is simply the truth." He had no answer. She could see him searching for one and not finding it, and she respected him enough not to feel the silence. "You should go," she said. He went. She was at the piano the evening he left, not playing, just sitting on the bench, her hands in her lap. And the memory came the way memories do when the mind has been holding them at a distance for too long and finally lets go. It had been February, 4 months before the garden party. Flora had been learning a simple piece, and Esther had been guiding her small hands over the keys, correcting the angle of her wrist. And Nathaniel had come into the music room quietly, the way he sometimes did in the evenings, drawn by the sound. He had stood behind them for a moment, and then he had reached past Esther's shoulder to turn the page of the music, and his hand had come down over hers on the keyboard, not grasping, not deliberate, simply landing there, the warmth of it, sudden and complete. 1 second. Neither of them had moved. Flora had kept playing, oblivious, her tongue between her teeth in concentration. And then Nathaniel had lifted his hand and stepped back. And Esther had turned the page herself, and nothing had been said, and nothing had been named. She had told herself afterward that it meant nothing. She had told herself this with some vigor. She sat on the bench in the schoolroom above the apothecary and looked at her hands on her knees and thought, I knew exactly what it was, and I stayed anyway. And I have no one to blame for that but myself. Then she stood, because sitting and thinking was not useful. And she had 14 girls coming in the morning who needed to learn their letters. She saw him again on a Wednesday in November at the market. She had not expected him. Meryton was not Ellingham, and Dukes did not generally appear at market stalls. But there he was, at the far end of the street, apparently on some business with a man who kept horses. And she was at the near end with her basket, and there was no avoiding it. She kept walking, because stopping would have been worse. She had not known, until she turned into the main street, that the story had arrived before her. She saw it in the way two women near the cheese stall looked at her and then away. She saw it in the set of a man's shoulders as he stepped back slightly to let her pass. Augusta's version of events. The scheming governess, the Duke's little mistake, a woman of no standing who had entertained ideas above herself, had come to Meryton by some route she could not trace, and it had done its work. The faces were not hostile, exactly. They were careful. The particular carefulness of people who have been told something and are waiting to see if it is true. Esther kept her chin level and her pace steady. She heard his step beside her before she saw him. Nathaniel had crossed the width of the market street without a word, and now he was walking next to her. Slightly ahead, his shoulder angled in a way that was not accidental. He did not speak. He did not look at the faces that turned toward them. He simply adjusted his pace to hers and put himself between her and the crowd's stares, walking the full length of the market street that way. A duke, absorbing the looks that had been aimed at a schoolteacher, his back straight, his expression entirely calm. And she felt something shift in her chest that she refused to name. They reached the end of the street. He touched his hat and walked back the way he had come, and she stood for a moment with her basket on her arm before she remembered where she was going. She was still standing there when the rider came. He was a young groom from Ellingham, and he had ridden hard, and he was trying to catch his breath. "Lady Flora," he said. "2 days she's been calling for you, Miss Wren. Fever. His Grace says..." He stopped. He looked at Nathaniel, who had turned at the sound of the horse. "His Grace says, please come." The night at Ellingham was long and specific in the way that nights of crisis always are, measured not in hours but in the small distances between one cold cloth and the next, between one labored breath and the one that follows it. Flora lay in her crib in the nursery, too hot and too still, and the fever had been 3 days building and was not yet ready to turn. The doctor had come and left instructions and would return in the morning. Mrs. Hodges, the old nurse who had been at Ellingham since Nathaniel was a boy, sat in the corner chair with her hands folded and her eyes on the child. Esther and Nathaniel worked without speaking. She wrung the cold cloths and laid them across Flora's forehead and wrists, and changed them when they warmed. He sat on the other side of the crib and held the child upright, when her breathing grew shallow and labored, his large hands careful and steady, and talked to her in a low voice. Not words of comfort, exactly. Just the sound of him, the familiar voice of her father. Something for Flora to hold on to in the dark. They moved around each other without colliding, without organizing it, handing things across the crib in silence when they were needed. Somewhere near 2 in the morning, Esther realized that her breathing had slowed to match Flora's, and that Nathaniel's had too, and that for some hours they had not been a duke and a dismissed governess, but simply two frightened people watching over a child they both loved. Mrs. Hodges spoke near 3 o'clock, in the particular low voice of someone who has decided that the truth is worth more than the quiet. "You want to know why he laughs?" she said to Esther. It was not a question. Esther looked up from the cloth she was wringing. "His mother," Mrs. Hodges said, "when he was small, 8, 9 years old, he had a dog he was fond of. He made the mistake of showing it, and Augusta sent the dog away. He had a friend, a boy from the village, that he was closer to than his brothers. Augusta found a reason to end the friendship. Everything he loved that she could see, she found a way to touch." The old woman's voice held no particular emotion, just the flatness of old fact. "He learned. By the time he was 12, he'd learned that if his mother couldn't see that something mattered, she couldn't take it. So he stopped letting her see." Esther set the cloth down slowly. "He laughed at you in that garden," Mrs. Hodges said, "to make her believe you were nothing to him. So she would lose interest and leave you be." She paused. "He was wrong. But it wasn't contempt." Esther sat with this for a long time, listening to Flora's breathing, which was steadier now than it had been an hour ago. She thought about the garden, the sun, the turned heads, the sound of his laugh landing on her like a closed door. And she let herself see it differently. Just once. Just to know what it looked like from the other side. A boy who had learned that love shown openly was love made available for damage. A man who had reached for a shield and found, too late, that he had aimed it at the wrong person. She understood it. She understood it completely. And it broke something in her that had been rigid since October. And she was still going back to Meryton. The fever broke at first light. Flora's temperature dropped slowly, like a tide going out. And by the time pale winter sun was coming through the nursery curtains, the child was sleeping properly. The deep, loose sleep of a body that has stopped fighting. Esther pressed the back of her hand to Flora's forehead and felt the ordinary warmth of a sleeping child, not the terrible dry heat of the night before. And she closed her eyes for a moment. Nathaniel was watching her from across the crib. His face was exhausted and unguarded in a way she had never seen it in daylight. "She'll be well," Esther said. He exhaled slowly. "Yes." He said it like a man who had not been entirely certain until this moment. "I want you to know," Esther said, "that I understand now what you did in the garden and why you did it. Mrs. Hodges told me." She met his eyes steadily. "I understand that the laugh was a shield. I understand that you thought it would protect me." She paused. "And I am still going back to Meryton. Understanding why someone hurt you is not the same as the hurt being enough. A love that can only protect by pretending not to love. That is not enough yet. Not for me." She picked up her shawl from the back of the chair. "Thank you for sending for me. For Flora." She left him there in the pale morning, beside the crib where his daughter slept. And she was halfway down the drive before she let herself feel how much it had cost her to walk away. Augusta came to Meryton on a Thursday in December, arriving in a carriage that was too large for the apothecary's narrow street and stopping traffic for 10 minutes. She came with her solicitor, a thin man named Greer, who carried a leather case and looked at the rooms above the apothecary with an expression of careful neutrality. Augusta herself looked at nothing with any expression at all. She had the manner of a woman who had never required the approval of a room and did not intend to begin now. Esther received them standing. Augusta waited while Greer produced a sealed document from the case and laid it on the table between them. "You will find the sum generous," Augusta said. "More than generous. It would settle you permanently, a cottage somewhere suitable, enough income to live without working. In exchange, you sign the document and agree not to contact Flora, or any member of the Devereux household, again." Esther picked up the document. She read it through completely, which took 2 minutes, during which Augusta said nothing and Greer looked at the window. Then Esther set it back on the table. "No," she said. Augusta's expression did not change. "I would advise you to consider carefully." "I have considered. I'm not a purchasable thing, Your Grace. I suspect you know that. And this visit is less about believing I'll sign than about making clear that you have the power to make the offer." Esther kept her voice even. "Flora is not yours to ration. She is a child who has known me since she was 2 years old. And whatever you think of me, she is not a bargaining piece." "She is my grandchild," Augusta said. "And you are a dismissed employee." "Yes," Esther said. "I am. And I built this school on my own, without the Duke's name or your permission. And 14 families in this town have chosen to send their daughters to me. And that has nothing to do with Ellingham Court. So you may take your document and go." Augusta left without the signature. Greer tucked the paper back into his case with the careful movements of a man who had seen refusals before and was professionally unsurprised. The carriage departed, and Mrs. Price appeared in the doorway with 2 cups of tea and the observation that the woman had a neck like a duchess and the soul of an auctioneer. Esther sat down after they were gone and felt the weight of what had been threatened settle into her properly. Not the money. She had never wanted the money. But Flora, the possibility that Augusta had the means and the will to enforce that distance, through legal channels or simply through the grinding pressure of class and influence, was real, and she knew it. And knowing it did not make it easier to hold. She was sitting with this when Nathaniel came, 10 days later, to tell her that Flora was fully recovered and asking for her. He stood in the doorway of the schoolroom in his overcoat, hat in hand, and she was at the table marking the girl's work. And for a moment, neither of them spoke. Then he crossed the room, and he took her right hand, ink stained at the fingers, rough at the knuckle from the cold, and turned it slowly in both of his, as though he were reading something written on the inside of her palm. A duke with a schoolteacher's hand between his, in a chalk-dusted room above an apothecary, turning it as though it were precious. He did not speak. He held it for a long moment, and then she drew it back, gently, and he let it go. "Thank you for coming," she said. He met her eyes steadily. "Always," he said. It was not a social answer. The sabotage came in January. Augusta, having failed with money, worked through influence instead. A letter to Mr. Cavendish, who had been one of the school's 2 sponsors since December, and a separate letter to a Mrs. Fallow, who had provided the other patronage, both letters containing the same information: that Miss Wren was a scheming former servant who had placed herself in a compromising proximity to the Duke of Ellingham, and that any family of standing associating with her school was associating with the story attached to her name. Both sponsors withdrew in the same week. Esther discovered this on a Monday morning when the vestry was unavailable and she had no explanation. By Tuesday she had the explanation, via the vicar, who was apologetic and clearly uncomfortable. She called a meeting for Wednesday evening. She sent word to every family who had a daughter in the school, to Mr. Alderton, to Mrs. Farrow from the mill, to the magistrate Sir Robert Kane, who had written her a reference in October and whose daughter was one of her best readers. She set up the chairs herself in the room above the apothecary, which was not large enough for everyone, and so they spilled into the landing and the top of the stair. She stood at the front, and she said what had happened. She said it plainly, without dramatics and without self-pity. She laid out her accounts on the table. Every penny that had come in, every penny spent, everything documented in her clear schoolteacher's hand. She showed them the attendance records. She read the references from Mr. Alderton and Sir Robert, who were both present, and nodded. She said, "You know this school. You have seen what your daughters have learned. I am asking you to decide on that basis, not on the basis of a letter written by a woman in a large house who has never been in this room." The room decided. Mr. Cavendish did not return. He was a cautious man, and Augusta's influence in his particular circles was too strong. But Mrs. Farrow announced that the mill would take on a portion of the sponsorship directly, and Sir Robert offered a modest sum, and three of the other parents contributed what they could. And by the end of the evening, the school had more sponsors than it had started with. Smaller individually, but collectively more rooted in Meryton than any single wealthy patron had ever been. Nathaniel came the following day. He stood in the doorway of the schoolroom after she had told him the outcome, and his face held something she had not seen there before. Not the charming ease or the careful blankness, but a straight, clear anger that was entirely on her behalf. "The slander," Esther said. "The mistake. Your mother can be defeated in every practical thing. And she is still winning the only argument that matters, because the only person who can unsay what was said in that garden is the man who laughed." She said it without accusation, just as fact. "I cannot refute it. My accounts and my attendance records cannot refute it. It will follow me because it came from you, not from her. She named me. You confirmed it." He stood very still. "I know," he said. "I'm not asking you to do anything," Esther said. "I'm telling you what is true." His voice was quiet. "I know what is true," he said, "and I know what I am going to do about it." He was almost at the door when she said, without entirely planning to, "You know, it's remarkable. A duke who rides 12 miles to stand in a chalk-dusted room and take a scolding, and he still manages to look as though he owns the building." He stopped. He turned. And he laughed. It was not the garden laugh, not the easy, social, armor-plated sound that had been his public face for 20 years. This was something else, entirely. Genuine, unguarded, surprised out of him. The laugh of a man who had not expected to be amused, and found he was, helplessly, at himself. It lasted only a moment. But it was real, and it filled the chalk-dusted room like sunlight through a window that had been shut for a long time. He was still laughing when he crossed back toward her, and she was still looking at him with an expression she had stopped trying to manage. And he kissed her. Slowly, with both hands framing her face, in the pale January light, with chalk dust in the air between them. And she did not stop him, and did not want to, and the room was very quiet afterward. "I'll come back," he said. She held his gaze. "I know," she said. The examination day was the last Saturday in March. When the light had just begun to remember, it was supposed to be warm. The assembly room above the Meryton Town Hall was the largest interior space available, and it was full by 9:30. Parents in their good coats, the vicar with his hands clasped, Sir Robert Kane in the front row with his daughter beside him, Mrs. Farrow and the mill families taking up 2 full benches, and the 14 girls of the school standing at their slates along the far wall in order of age, from Bess Farrow at 5 to Mary Alderton at 12. All of them wearing the particular expression of children who have been told this is important and have decided to believe it. Nathaniel sat in the third row among the townspeople, not at the front, not beside the vicar or beside Sir Robert. He had arrived early and taken a bench like anyone else, and he sat there in his good coat with his hat on his knee. And if anyone thought it remarkable that the Duke of Ellingham was sitting in the third row of a schoolroom examination in a market town, they did not say so. Esther stood at the front and opened the proceedings. The girls recited their letters. They recited their numbers. They read aloud in turns from the primer, some haltingly, some with the smooth confidence of children who have discovered that they can do a thing and are pleased about it. Mary Alderton read a passage from a history of England that she had not seen before, and she read it without a single error. And her father, who could not himself read well, sat in the second row with his hands pressed flat on his thighs and his jaw set against something he was not going to let happen to his face in public. Augusta arrived at 11:15. The door at the back of the room opened, and she came in with the solicitor Greer and a woman Esther did not know. And she moved toward the front with the unhurried certainty of a person who has never encountered a room that did not rearrange itself to receive her. The assembly shifted. Esther felt the shift and kept her face still. Augusta stopped near the front row and drew breath to speak. Mr. Alderton said calmly, "We are in the middle of the examination, Your Grace. Bess, if you please. The second line." Bess Farrow, who was 5 years old and afraid of very little, recited the second line. Augusta stood. No one moved for her. Sir Robert did not stand. Mrs. Farrow did not move aside. The parents on the benches stayed where they were, and the girls stayed at their slates, and the room simply continued around Augusta as though she were a piece of furniture that had been placed in an inconvenient location. Esther watched the realization move across Augusta's face, that here, in this room, she had no architecture to stand on. There was no hierarchy she could invoke, no social mechanism she could operate, because this was not her world, and the people in it had not given her the keys to it. Augusta found her footing. She always did, I think, she said, in the carrying voice she had used in the garden at Ellingham, that before this proceeds further, this assembly should know the full history of the woman who calls herself its schoolmistress. A dismissed employee. A woman who spent 6 years cultivating an attachment to a household above her station, and who was removed when that attachment became. She paused with the precision of someone choosing a word. Inconvenient. The room was quiet. Not the quiet of agreement, the quiet of people waiting to see what happens next. Nathaniel stood up. He stood from the third row bench without hurry, and he turned to face the room. Not his mother, but the room, the parents, and the vicar, and Sir Robert, and the Mill families, and the five-year-old with her slate. And he spoke in a voice that was entirely plain. "The only error made at Ellingham Court," he said, "was mine." Augusta turned toward him. Her expression shifted into something that was not quite surprise and not quite warning. "I laughed," Nathaniel said, "in the garden, in front of the county, when my mother called this woman a mistake. I laughed because I have laughed at everything I loved since I was old enough to know that showing my mother what I valued was the same as handing her the means to damage it. I laughed to make her believe Miss Wren meant nothing to me, so that she would look elsewhere." He paused. "It was a lie, and I told it in public, and she paid for it. That is the full history. It belongs to me, not to her." He was not using the Duke's voice. He was using his own, which was quieter and more direct, and, Esther thought, considerably more frightening. "I am renouncing, in front of this room, every claim to my mother's approval, her house, her management of my household, and her interference in my life and in the lives of the people I choose to keep in it. These are the terms I'm giving up. Are the terms I am giving them up in front of the people who witnessed the original humiliation, because that is where the debt belongs. Augusta drew a long breath. She was formidable. She had always been formidable. And she was not finished. She turned to the room with the expression of a woman who has one weapon left and intends to use it. "The Duke's little mistake," she said, into the assembled silence. It was her best line. It had always worked. It had the force of a word that has been said so many times, it begins to feel like the truth. Nathaniel laughed. Not the armor. Not the deflection. Not the practiced, easy sound that had served him as a shield for 30 years. He laughed the way he had laughed in the chalk-dusted schoolroom in January, surprised, open, helpless with it. The laugh of a man who has set down something very heavy and discovered that his hands are free. It was an ordinary sound. It was the most extraordinary sound in the room. Augusta stood with her mouth open for one moment, and in that moment, every person present could see it. The instrument had been removed from her hands. Her only tool, in every scene of every year, had been his fear. Fear of her disapproval. Fear of her reach. Fear of what she would do to the things he loved if she saw that he loved them. The fear was gone. The laugh said so, plainly, in front of witnesses, and there was nothing she could do to put it back. She left. Greer held the door. The woman Esther did not know followed without looking back, and the door closed, and the room breathed. Mr. Alderton said, into the silence, "Jane Holt. The multiplication tables, if you please." Jane Holt, who was 8 and had been watching all of this with enormous eyes, recited the multiplication tables. She knew them perfectly. The examination continued. The families left in the mid-afternoon, in ones and twos, with the particular satisfied noise of people who have witnessed something they will be describing for years. The girls were collected by their mothers, each of them clutching a small card that Esther had written out by hand. Their names, their progress, a line about what they had mastered and what they were working toward. Flora, who had come with Nathaniel and spent the examination sitting beside him with the focused attention she brought to everything she considered worth her time, was the last child in the room. She stood at Esther's side and watched the door close behind the final family. "You were very good today," Flora told her in the tone of a child delivering a considered verdict. "Thank you," Esther said seriously. "So were you." "I didn't do anything." "You sat still for 2 hours. For you, that is remarkable." Flora considered this and appeared to find it fair. Nathaniel appeared in the doorway from the anteroom, where he had been helping Mr. Alderton fold the extra chairs, and Flora went to him and took his hand. And the three of them were briefly a triangle in the empty room, which felt both ordinary and entirely new. "Go and find Mrs. Price," Esther told Flora. "Tell her I said you may have a biscuit." Flora went. Nathaniel stayed. He stood in the middle of the room that she had built, in the town she had chosen, among the people who had stood up for her because she had given them reason to, and he looked at her with his face entirely open. No performance in it. No ease, no deflection. "I am not asking you to come back to Ellingham," he said. "I want to be clear about that. I am not asking you to return to any part of the life you left." Her voice was firm. "Good," Esther said. "Because I am keeping the school, and my name, and this room." He nodded once. "I know." "If you come into my life," she said, "you come in as a man who enters on my terms, not as a duke who absorbs a governess back into his household." I will not be absorbed. I spent 6 years being useful in someone else's house and calling it belonging, and I know the difference now. Yes, he said. I know you do. I am not asking you to give up your title or your estate or the things that are legitimately yours, she said. I am asking you to understand that what I have built here is also legitimately mine, and that any life we make is made between equals, or it is not made at all. Those are your terms, he said. They are. Then I agree to them, he said, without negotiating. She looked at him for a long moment. This man she had known for 6 years, who had made her angry and frightened and hopeful and furious, and in the end, had stood up in a room full of witnesses and said the true thing at full cost. And she said simply, "All right." He crossed the room. He took both her hands, the ink-stained and the cold, and held them, and did not say anything else, because there was nothing else that needed saying. The schoolroom in the early morning, before the girls arrive, has a particular quality of light. Chalk pale, coming in low from the east window, making the air look as though it is made of something finer than air. The slates are stacked against the wall. The primer is open on the table at the page where yesterday's lesson ended. On the peg beside the door, a good wool overcoat hangs next to a dark shawl, the shoulders almost touching. Somewhere deeper in the building, a child's voice calls out. Bright, demanding, entirely certain of being heard. Calling both their names at once, the way she always does. As though the two of them together are a single answerable thing. And in the quiet that follows, from somewhere in the direction of the kitchen, there is a sound. A man laughing. For no particular reason. Simply because he is in a room that is his, with people who are his on a morning that belongs entirely to the life he chose. And the sound is easy and warm and ordinary. And it fills the chalk pale light the way sunlight fills a room when someone finally opens the window. It is the most ordinary sound in the world. It is the sound the story was always moving toward.